welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig.
Renee.
And Tony again.
And Kim sitting in the background, who may not say anything. And we're here at the Agile Australia Conference in Melbourne, and it's a great pleasure to have one of the keynote speakers with us, and one of the people I've been following in the Agile community, and I know you guys have as well, Jim Benson.
Definitely a ditto.
Welcome, Jim. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello. An absolute great pleasure, Jim. Well, we'll do the soft clapping.
Thank you. Well, yes. Apparently, I sound like Nick Cage to everybody, so that was one of the tweets this morning, was that if you closed your eyes, I sounded exactly like Nicolas Cage.
But without the mugshot, right?
Without the you just watch out. I can get violent at any time.
Okay, excellent.
And so the schlock movies. Yeah.
So for those who don't know you, I mean we and I guess you came to prominence for us, I guess, with personal Kanban book. But there's I guess so much more to your story. What in a nutshell is the Jim Benson story? How'd you get in this whole Agile Kanban?
How do you become someone who's seen as an expert in personal and group productivity? It's definitely not something you go to university for. So I started off in psychology, almost graduated in psychology, decided that wasn't the direction I wanted to go because I really did want to apply things. So I went into urban planning and built giant things, built freeways and subway systems and things with multi-billion-dollar price tags. And there was always like this little line item in that said software. So software to me was a line item. It was not the be-all and end-all of the world, but I left that field, the consulting engineering field, to go into software development, opened a company to make software. And we were an XP shop as soon as XP had a name. Before that, we were a stuff that we're talking about right now shop. And we got government to write us tender around those type of projects. So we were able to say we want to work in an iterative way. We want to have a conversation throughout the project. We don't want any change orders, which for government clients was like, what do you mean no change orders? That's how we run business. But we tried our best to never have change orders because we tried to anticipate change. As we were doing that, we realized, you know, Agile does a lot of the things that it's supposed to do pretty well, and then it kind of falls on its face for a lot of the other things. Are there ideas that we can bring in to augment Agile? And so we started working with Lean, and around that time, every Wednesday night, my friend David Anderson and I would go sit in a pub, and we would do two things. We would talk about our crazy home situations, and we would talk about crazy work situations. And one of the things we're trying to do was implement David's first book, which was called Agile Management, which had a lot of good ideas, but even Dave couldn't figure out how to implement it. And Kanban ended up becoming the way that we implemented those ideas. And Dave took those back to Microsoft. I did them at my company. And since I always had a basis in psychology, I focused on the person. David focused on the org. And that's why we have David's Kanban method and we have personal Kanban. It's just two different viewpoints on the same solution set.
So what is the difference between personal Kanban and David's Kanban?
Well, so David's Kanban is set up for large organizations that have a largely set value stream. The value stream using the Kanban method will change over time, but personal Kanban is set up to deal with a high level of ambiguity, a lot of consistent change, and the Kanban method is a little bit more stable,
right,
if you will. David's focus is large organizational communications, development, management, and elucidating that structure through the board. And ours is more, you don't know what that structure is, and let's start sleuthing it out and figuring out how you work as a team, how you work as individuals, how you need to communicate with other people, and using the tool for that.
You think this came from? I mean, so you mentioned XP, which lights my heart because that's where we started.
Craig and I started together, XP,
Again very early. But it was missing that key ingredient very good at the technical practices, but by design was a little lightweight on the people and the
right
and the process. And Scrum really, to me, wasn't you know, wasn't necessarily the answer. So is that kind of what drove this, was you had to fill some gaps?
Yeah, so each of these, if you think of each of these as products, Kent Beck is a friend of mine. I like him a lot. I think I'm pretty safe in saying that all of the four products that we just mentioned exemplify the person or the people who launched them. So Kent is very technically adept. He's very team focused, and he's very interested in producing high quality software. Kent is not focused on large scale organizational communication or making sure that individuals get the comfort that they need. Scrum is a product that was developed in order to be sold to organizations that didn't want to hear the word extreme in something. Mm-hmm. It was built as a product first and a methodology second, and the adoption rate and some of the side effects that we see are due to that. David is very much, like I said, he's large organization focused, and I am more communication and interpersonal focused. And so what I'm hoping that people do is they go out and they treat this as a farmer's market of ideas, and Kent has come up with a bunch of ideas, and Schwaber came up with a bunch of ideas, and Anderson came up with a bunch of ideas, and I've come up with a bunch of ideas, and hopefully people go from stall to stall and they say, I need some of Jim's communication, I need some of David's organizational interaction, I need some of Kent and Beck's quality stuff, and I need some of Scrum.
The Oath of Non-Allegiance.
Yeah. So the Oath of Non-Allegiance, so you know, big Coburn fans as well, as you may have realised. But for me, that the thing that stuck out, you just said before, you know, augmenting what Agile does with these pieces. There seems to be a real thing happening at the moment where there's the Agile people versus the Kanban people.
Yeah.
And for me, that's a great perturbance, because I think that's the
most... We're all against the safe people.
I'm so not going there today after Martin's comment yesterday afternoon. But for me, that's a real perturbance, because we're going to eat our own.
Yes, and we do regularly. So one of the things here is that if you consider software development as a culture, a global culture of people who aren't very good at communicating with other people, and we are developing processes to help us communicate with each other and with other people outside of the tribe, if you will. And each of these systems are, as I said, you know, they've been developed with a different focus or a different aesthetic, and sometimes you need to have different conversations, so you need to employ different tools. The problem is that as any idea comes along, so when I get up on stage and I do one of my wacky speeches, and then somebody comes up to the end and said, "You completely nailed my pain." Now what's happened is I have got myself a convert, and now that convert will go to battle for me, and they will react negatively when they see me being attacked. On the other hand, when people attack me, I'm just kind of like, yes, attack me some more. Because when they're attacking me, what they're actually doing is they're attacking the boundaries of the ideas, hopefully, unless they're a zealot for somebody else, and then they're attacking me because they see me as attacking, you know, Kent or Dean or somebody. The sad part about these culture, well, the inevitable part of these culture wars is that that's what comes from somebody being liberated from pain that they had before and their gratitude for being liberated from that pain. So XP has liberated people, Scrum has liberated people, Big K Kanban has liberated people, Personal Kanban has liberated people. And in David's book, it says repeatedly, don't do what's in this book. In the Black Book, Ken Schwaber repeatedly says, don't do what's in this book. In Personal Kanban, it repeatedly says, don't do what's in this book. People buy the books and do exactly what's in them. It works, but now they don't know why. Mm. And then they treat it as a religious artifact. The book saved me. as opposed to the idea allowed me to better deal with my situation. And I'm as guilty as anybody for throwing fuel on the fire for the scrum versus Kanban or blah, blah versus blah, blah, blah thing. But mostly it was we had reached, in about 2007, we'd reached a horrible level of complacency where nobody was questioning anything. And so it was partially my job to help do that. That was way too long for a audio interview. Sorry about that.
Well, if your intention was to throw fuel on the fire, I think you succeeded.
So you mentioned, I think yesterday, that you're working on a new book. Is that right?
So we've just released the Why Limit Whip book. That's been out for about a month. The Why Plans Fail book before that, which was about cognitive bias and kind of how we become enamored with these ideas and how hard it is to get away from them. Those two books are out now. And the Why Limit Whip book was important because it's really easy to tell people that we shouldn't do more work than we can handle, but it's very hard for people to communicate that up and down the chain and even to themselves, you know, to know why taking on too much work is so detrimental. And then the upcoming work is a book that has no firm title yet, but it's about meetings. So what a meeting is, why it's necessary, why we should have more of them, and why everyone we've ever had was crap. And as is kind of common for Tony Ann and myself, all of our recommendations are exactly the opposite of all of the recommendations that you find in books about having good meetings. So we say, I'll say strong agenda, we say no agenda. They say no windows, we say lots of windows. They say no food, we say lots of food. Basically trying to turn meetings into humane working sessions and no longer into agenda-driven information nozzles.
On the humane element there, you mentioned in your talk yesterday, I'm going to paraphrase now, that individuals and interactions is effectively redundant. Do you want to expand a little bit more on why you feel at this point in time, because you did mention it was a point in time, that it was relevant back then when it was stated in the manifesto.
Right.
Why do you feel it's relevant now?
The Agile Manifesto is a manifesto. Any manifesto is by its nature a basis for liberation theology. The oppressed class of workers known as software developers wanted to rise up from their overpaid depths and take arms against those who would keep them down. What had happened was the Agile Manifesto was basically a bunch of developers saying, I'm mad as hell and I won't take it anymore. My professional pride will not allow me to have you force me to create crappy software anymore. Very necessary document for 1997 or so. Because at that point, it was fully a demand-driven economy where someone would come to you and say, I want this ill-formed, overly developed, overly restrictive set of features to turn into something else in 6 months. Now you take it and go. Just like I will get on stage now and I will say overly combative things about Scrum because I'm trying to shake people out of a sense of complacency, the Agile Manifesto overstated certain things in order to shake people out of a certain sense of complacency. But now the Agile Manifesto has become, this will happen to the stuff I'm saying too. Mm. When something's been around long enough and it has been a liberation theology, it translates into dogma. And that particular phrase, the lead phrase, which in general, if we walked around this room and said, what does the Agile Manifesto say? That's the only thing they could tell you that it says. If only we were so good with the Ten Commandments, because then people wouldn't kill each other anymore, right? but then again, you know, the Ten Commandments have become, thou shalt not kill unless I'm supposed to kill you, right? So now individuals and interactions over processes and tools has become individuals and actions over processes and tools, except when that process is Scrum. So we will allow Scrum so overshadows individuals and interactions now, it's not even funny.
Oh, I completely agree. Yeah.
So when I say that the couplet there, that dualism that is represented by individuals and actions over products and tools or processes and tools, we need to understand that processes and our interactions are actually the exact same thing. The process is the system, and the interactions of the components of a system are the system. So what you've said here is basically interactions and processes, one's over the other, but they're the same thing. And when we start to do that, then we start to separate ourselves from the process, and we allow textbook or consultant-driven Scrum to replace healthy Scrum. And healthy Scrum is, I want to adhere to the ideals that are in the Black Book.
Yeah.
But I understand that my context makes me have to make that malleable.
Does that go back to Deming's rule?
Which
the
rule?
95% of the problems in this
system. Well, it does. Deming was overstating something in that rule in order to shake up the status quo.
It's in a trend here.
Yes. when Deming said the 95-5 rule, I mean, the numbers are completely arbitrary.
Yes.
They are completely wrong.
Yes.
But the point is that if you don't have some modicum of systems thinking, you're going to constantly be engaging in fundamental attribution error and blaming people when the problems are systemic. And if we separate ourselves as people from the process, then we're exacerbating that, because we're allowing the processes to develop in an anti-human way while we're humans, and we're saying, we're humans over here, you do that process stuff over there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, whenever I first heard that rule and sort of related it to the first line in the Agile Manifesto, I think my concern was around people who may have had psychological disorders. So really bad management.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of the context is, well, the system isn't keeping those managers in line either. So
right.
whilst they as human beings may be absolutely horrible people, nothing in the system was controlling that behavior.
So what I find is, there are studies that show that most people who rise up to the level of CEO, or to personalize this a bit, to thought leader, generally have some nasty personality disorder. they are going to be overly egotistical. And they're going to start to do things like expect other people to answer them. So, do you know who I am syndrome? There's two things about that. One is, I think that people, that even though they do a study and they say most CEOs are narcissistic, they may not have started out that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, somebody was mentioning that, Simon Bennett was mentioning this on the walk to dinner last night, where he said, why does Bono think that he can fly around the world and talk about all of these political things when he is a pop star? And you just get so used to people listening to you that you're just like, people should always listen to me because I'm really amazing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why would we even mention George Clooney?
No, I'm in a group of guys here.
I don't want to spend my whole time with my head on my side like this, right? Yeah, sorry. Humor for that.
So, what I'm middle managers are usually individual contributors that either because of honest performance, bad metrics, or some other system have risen to.
Bad luck.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, or disluck or unluck. Because a lot of them get there and they're saying, this is not the software development I signed up for. We have had in software development and in knowledge work, we have a hard time figuring out what managers are supposed to do because we don't understand what our mechanism of production is. And truth be told, we actually don't understand what anybody does. We just understand that they're the narc or the principal or, you know, they're the person who's responsible for telling us that we did something wrong. They, on their side, have been told by people above them, you have to give me statistical proof that you're awesome. And they become driven by those statistics. So like balanced scorecards drive me nuts because balanced scorecards are basically, could be useful if in the right hands, and out of the 9 billion people on Earth, there's maybe half a dozen hands that they could be used well in. They are pistols, you know. They're used a lot in crimes of passion. So this has been a theme throughout the whole conference and through Agile. So Agile as a way of life is anti-manager. You know,
Agile's really revolutionizing HR to some extent, right?
Yeah, well, but Agile is also running around basically, like the Bard said, kill all the managers, right?
I think it's ignoring HR, actually, if you really think about it.
I actually think it's a bad thing that we are ignoring HR. There's a huge growth area in us focusing less on software developers and focusing on the HR
group. Which is actually interesting because I just read just last night that the Agile Alliance, their next big thing is Agile and HR. That's where they're focusing.
Yeah. The thing is that when I hear Agile, the word Agile, the first word that comes to my mind is iterations.
Really?
Yeah. And so iterative HR sounds like one of the absolute worst ideas I could possibly think of. And the thing is I've seen this. I've seen where Agile coaches will go into like the creative side. So
knowledge work?
Yeah, the creative side of knowledge work. And they'll start saying things like, well, to marketers, you know, the first thing we need to do is set you up on a, you know, a 2-week iteration. And then the marketers are saying, do you know how marketing works? Do you know how sales works? Sales works on one principle, and that's the oh shit principle. Somebody comes and says, you need this tomorrow, and then you say, oh shit, and then you have to do it.
Visualize your work. That should be the first thing, right?
Yeah. So it's the, what Scrum and XP were trying desperately to do was eliminate unplanned work from software development.
Yeah.
And we can kind of do that. But there's a lot of other professions where if you try and do that, all you do is limit opportunity.
Yeah.
And already the encapsulated Scrum model where you can't bug the team for 2 weeks, that already destroys opportunity.
Yeah,
So if we can, my goal is not to bash Scrum. My goal is to take the good things that we've discovered over the last 15 or 20 years and bring other good things together with that and not talismanize the other stuff. So, you know, I have a really hard time with people doing Kanban to not make their Kanban either look like ready, doing, done, or from page 28 of David's book.
Right.
Okay. So it's like, I've seen this one, that's the one we're going to use. It's like, God.
What's the right one for you?
Yes. And what's the right one for you today? Because next week is going to be different.
And I think that kind of brings the question to me is that I guess Kanban's been one of those evolutions. So I believe we had to start with Scrum because that made sense in 1998 or wherever it was. And Kanban came along at the right time, and Lean Startup is following behind it and building on those things. And I mean, it doesn't imply the visualization.
Yep.
But one of the things I really struggle with Kanban is that it really requires that discipline that I guess was built into Scrum a little bit by the fact that, you know, at least there was iterations to kind of hold you honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's why it drove you to write the book about WIP. What are you seeing? Because what really annoys me is the people who come up to me as a coach, and you guys, we've talked about this before, and they go, here's my Kanban board. And the first thing I go is,
it's not a Kanban board.
Where's your whip limit?
Yeah. Yes.
Just cycle time. So the first thing you see is a great big column full of things.
Yes.
And lots of things.
Yes.
It's like, so what are you seeing there? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, obviously that's why you drove you to write the...
Yeah. Well, and so the... there are people who have Kanban tools out there that don't have explicit whip limits. And,
well, it's a lean startup, right?
That's actually one of the guys said was, he said, I'm lean startup, I'll do that in my next one. And I was like, great, so if you develop your lean car, please don't decide that rubber is waste and have no tires, you know.
Not needed. Right.
Yes. So, I mean, there's that, and that's kind of an implementation issue. I would say that the bigger thing is, in software especially, is assuming that simply visualizing your work is what is when you're done. That's your definition of done. So I've visualized my work, now I'm done. Or I've visualized my work and I'm limiting my work in progress and now I'm done. It's like, okay, now...
Where's the managed flow bit?
Yeah, well, have you thought about why you're doing that? Have you thought about, you know, is... what upsets you every week? Is there a way that you can stop doing those things? Because what's going to happen is exactly what Ken Schwaber said when he wrote his first big criticism of Kanban. We went from death marches in Waterfall to death sprints in Scrum. And now there's a real threat with Kanban that you can go to death flow, where you're just like, I gotta pull the next ticket, I gotta pull the next ticket, I gotta pull the next ticket. It's like, no, that's not the point. The point is to create an actual sustainable pace by not giving yourself an opportunity to overload. One of the things that Dean's trying to do with SAFE, you know, and obviously I could go on for days about frustrations I have with SAFE. But one of the things that Dean's trying to do with SAFE, with release trains, is he's trying to create a coherent release, not only cadence, but story. And I think that's ridiculously important. So people say, well, I'm going from these 2-week releases, which is like how I know when I'm gonna get things done. And he said, and I'm like, really? Because if you really listen to that, then you're saying, I'm so glad I got away from deadlines and milestones in Waterfall so that I could replace them with more deadlines and milestones in Scrum, which is not the point. The point is better conversations.
Predictability?
Understanding.
Yeah.
Not predictability, but understanding. So I understand the makeup of my work. I understand the rate of planned work, of unplanned work, what catches us up, where our bottlenecks are, and then I go to work starting to do that so that I can release variation, which increases coherence, but it doesn't necessarily increase what we call predictability, because predictability says that at the beginning of this, I know what the end state is going to be, and then I'm going to get to that end state in the way I thought I was going to.
Predictability in the context of, at some point in time, having a stable velocity.
Right, and so you can never have a stable velocity because velocity is meaningless. You can have stable flow and a stable throughput.
No, but my points, we talked about this, I got to get my points.
That's right, I got to get my points. And yeah, so you have to get your artifact, right? your KRs, right? You need to get your KPIs. And what we want to understand is our work has a natural flow. That flow has a rate, and that rate is a general level of throughput. But what we want in our releases is to have something that creates not just demonstrable value, because we've all sat through demos where we say, I did this, and this unrelated thing, and this unrelated thing, and this other crap that I'm not sure why I did it, but it's done, and here I can demo it. What we want to do is say, okay, I've got I've got a release, and this release is all about making the customer experience better when they actually complete a transaction. So we made the credit card processing form 3 pages into 1 page. We made a single sign-on. We created a report that they would email you immediately saying when you're going to get your thing and blah, 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 blah. And this creates now a release story that people can actually grok. And it might take you 5 days to release that. It might take you 3 weeks to release that. But when you have a release, it's a meaningful piece of meta value, not just user stories that we're able to have sometimes spurious and often arbitrary customer value. So that's a release. The every 2 weeks giving people stuff that we could cram into 2 weeks is just kind of like a vomit value, or value vomit. Yes.
Yeah, vomit value. Vomit value. VV.
We've got a podcast
name. I think we've got a podcast. So listen. One of the things for me is I've done quite a bit of lean, and I worked and the variations of lean. I was taught by the Toyota type guys. One of the things we struggle with in the early days, and I see it happening still, is its standardization to the abstraction of the human.
Oh, you bet.
And it drives me completely insane that, you know, I think I saw it on your slide because it's a term I use all the time. The humans are the ghost in the machine. They're the blip in the radar that we cannot standardize for.
Yep.
So I'm interested to plumb some thoughts from you from that, because it's something that I talk to people. I'm really passionate, as these two guys know about.
I thought you were a lean sensei, aren't you? Just,
he wasn't trained by Toyota. He just worked at a Toyota dealership.
That's going to be nuts and stuff on him.
I mentioned this in the talk the other day, but if you have a team, and it's a close-knit team, and some folks leave and some other people come on, your team changes. If you're married to somebody and you get a divorce and you marry someone else, your definition of marriage changes. We interact with other people, and if we don't, then we're just machines, or we're slaves, one of the two. We're meat puppets at that point. And we're not. So we need to have a very strong, not only understanding, but appreciation for the fact that we work with other people and they're really great. And sometimes they're cranky. And there was one company that I was working with, and they were listing out what was going to happen when they rolled out a new set of process improvements to the rest of the organization. And they're like, this person's going to be fine, this person's going to rejoice, this person's going to be great. And then they got this one person, they said, this guy is going to be cranky, because he's always cranky. And they drew like this little angry face next to him. And yeah, yeah. And the thing is that, so I said, you know, is this person detrimentally cranky? And they're like, no, we love him. He's great. He's just cranky. Right? And so we have different personalities that we work with, that we love, that we appreciate, that sometimes are less happy than we would like them to be. That's okay. But we need to understand that, that doesn't mean that, you know, it frustrates me when people say, well, we're going to start this new collaborative culture, and the first thing that we're going to do is make sure that everybody's collaborative, and if they're not, then we'll sack them, and we'll go out and we'll find some collaborative things. And then what you get is
clones.
Yeah, collaborative robots, right?
Meetings will continue until collaboration improves.
That's right.
Tases everywhere.
But then the other thing is that then what the definition of collaboration is will close in upon you. And you'll get really Orwellian really fast. And I've worked with many collaborative companies that have almost zero tolerance for dissent, because collaboration is don't rock the boat. And so that's really dangerous. So for me, the nature of lean, the nature of being able to stop the line at a moment's notice, the nature of appreciating the Andon cord, you know, being able to say, shit happened, stop by and tell me how to fix it. That's That is, you know, the one of the talks the other day made the, you know, reminded everybody of the point that Toyota measures success not by how little they have to stop the line or that the end-on cord is pulled, but how often that happens. And the more often that happens, the happier they are, because each one of those things is a little, not so little, or huge improvement.
And I think that's why so many people have tried to copy the Toyota culture, right?
Right.
Failed miserably.
Yes.
Because they take the derivative of the process.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. People,
but they don't let the volatility. Well, they don't let the volatility of the human in the mix.
People don't realize it took 20 years for them to get to that culture point, and no one wants to invest 20 years in a culture change these days.
Can't we change culture in 10 minutes?
Well, people also don't realize is that middle managers at Toyota are literally working themselves to death.
Yeah.
They will leave house, kiss their wives goodbye, get on the train, and die on the way to work. Because Toyota is literally lean, in Japan is literally working people to death.
Why?
Because they are so invested in what's happening at work that they never leave work. Right. And so now the culture change in Toyota that they're working really hard to...
Sustainable pace.
Is, well, not just a sustainable pace, but basically what's good for your life is good for Toyota. So don't come to work at 5 o'clock in the morning and leave at 8 o'clock at night. You know, go play with your kids, you know, go to the park, do these things, do those things. And that's harder to get rid of, because when I was working in Japan, a day was literally that. You'd show up at work at 7 o'clock in the morning and you'd get home at 10 o'clock at night. Not because you were working, you'd leave at five, but you'd leave with all of your coworkers and you'd all go out and you'd have a nice dinner and then you'd go to...
It's just like a conference event.
Yes, yes, yes. Non-stop for your entire life. And you know, this is one of the reasons why the personal Kanban book, and you know, personal Kanban is kind of a bad name because people think it relates to the individual, but it's like, no, what we're saying is when you're at work, you're alive. And when you go home, you're alive. And you care about what's at work. So you take your work home with you and you take home to work with you. There is no division. We don't silo our lives. We might sublimate some things. So you might have like a horrible row with your spouse and then go to work and you're like, I'm not gonna think about that right now. And then, you know, you push it back a little bit, but it's still there. You know, someone comes up, you know, then you're like, right?
It's supposed to make us a whole, right?
Yes. And I'll tell the story the nice way. One of the companies that we worked with, there was a woman who was going through significantly bad things at home. Lots of illness, lots of problems that had, you know, it was basically perfectly fine, and then all these things happen at once. Multiple people with life-threatening issues, and so this woman was quite frazzled. And her whip limit was basically went from 3 or 4 to maybe a half. You know, you can do a half of a thing at a time. Her management, while they may not have handled this perfectly, went to her and basically said, look, we're going to scale back your duties for a while until you can heal and come back. And as team members, you know, while some people don't like to let other people into their dirt, you know, it should be perfectly acceptable for someone to come to work and say, man, I
don't have the headspace today for this.
Yes, yeah. So can I just kind of Pomodoro my day out and kind of hide in my office for a while? And
cry a little.
Yeah, yeah. And that since we are the things that create software, expecting people to come to work and completely sublimate the stuff that's going on is completely counterproductive to the team. So if you have a developer that is completely freaked out because their daughter's in the hospital, the last thing you want is to say, okay, you're now the release manager for this, you know, this upcoming sprint. And we do that to people all the time.
We see it all the time.
Yeah. And so that's the thing, is the software is built by humans.
And I think that's, for me, the bit where the individuals and interactions really is important in that statement. Maybe not over the process and tools,
yes.
But that's...
No, it's and. It's not over, it's and.
Yeah, remember the little statement that everyone forgets at the bottom there?
Yeah.
Left and the right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean...
Lost me value there, something.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, they're saying, you know, right now we're emphasizing these things on the left more.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
we've been there, and
left
Alex
and right are still the same on the other side of the world.
That's right. Enough. This is a toilet flushing. So, it's at the time of the release of the Agile Manifesto, that was the point that needed to be made. And indeed, to some organizations, it still is. As us, as a group of practitioners who have been doing this for a while, we kind of need to throttle that back a little bit and bring them in line, because what we're starting to do is we're starting to do really bad things. Mm. Product owners are really bad things. Product owners are impermeable gateways between value creation and value inception.
That's why I started a no product owner movement. didn't take off as much as no estimates, though.
That's nice, because that's actually NOPO. That kind of flows right off the top.
Oh, yeah, NOPO.
But the thing about it is that the role that the product owner should be is totally necessary. But we all know, we go to 10 companies, we'll find 60 different identifications of what a product owner is.
In reality, it's all a middleman to the customer.
Yeah, yeah. And the product owner should be the person who is the steward of the value stream. They understand customer needs, they understand what the team's able to create, and they're able to watch movement while other people are focused on their part of the value stream, and then bring people from here into conversations over here and back again, but not serve as the person who's the telephone operator, you know, saying this person said this, and then the other person's like, no, I didn't. You know?
Why do you say management's not the... I know we're out of time, but why do you say management's not the steward of the value stream?
Product owner is management.
Oh,
the product owner is a BA. So the first thing that we did when we started Agile was we got rid of project managers and BAs. And then the second thing that we did was we invented Scrum Masters and product owners. Because they're actually natural roles. They're completely natural roles.
So true.
And we can't sublimate them, but what we can do is actually embrace them and say, look, you're a valid team member, and we need to find out the best way to help you allow us all to create value, because we are, and I'll tell you, the stuff in the Certified Product Owner class is some of the most scary Orwellian crazy talk I've ever seen. Sorry about that. I would like us to be able to teach people to identify roles and responsibilities as the needs for those roles and responsibilities become evident. I want roles and responsibilities to be as fungible as columns on a Kanban board. So when context changes and we need a different org, we can come up with that different org.
I don't think I've ever been on a podcast where we've all just stood that sat there for 40 minutes and just nodded all the way through it. So, Jim, there's so many more things we could talk about. Lucky you do come to Australia on a fairly regular basis, so we'll have to get you back. But for people who aren't aware of your work, I mean, obviously the great Personal Kanban book, which is awesome, plus your new stuff. If people want to know more about you or harass you on the interweb, where do they find you?
Well, I am Our Founder on Twitter, which is the word our followed by the word founder. And no, that's not because I'm narcissistic, but it's a long story that I won't get into right now. The Personal Kanban site is probably the easiest one to find. And my email and everything can be found through there. Tony Ann and I are extremely accessible. And our corporate culture is based on friendliness and accessibility, despite otherwise bitchy things I might say. So how about opinionated friendliness? If Schwaber were here, I would give him a big hug.
Well, we appreciate your time. It's great to have you down in Melbourne for the Agile Australia Conference.
Uh-huh.
And I know you're back on stage at lunchtime, so we're looking forward to that, and enjoy the rest of your tour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.